All right, if everyone's got that, let me move in. What I want to talk about here again is commercial technologies that are available now, that are running now, and that are able to be used. Because of the other speeches, I'm going to skip talking about 802.11. For those of you who are not from the U.S., I apologize right now. The presentation here is focused on systems that are available in the United States. They're primarily terrestrial networks. The satellite stuff I'll talk about in the second session. Here's the things that I want to cover in the speech. One is a quick walkthrough of some of the radio frequency things that wireless people deal with and are facile with, but that if you're not dealing with this kind of thing, you may not be aware of some of the issues. We'll go through the mobile telephony stuff, the different cellular systems, talk about CDPD, talk about Nextel, which is a kind of a hybrid, some private data networks, two-way paging, Bluetooth, and we'll try to wrap it up with some 3G, third generation stuff. Again, I'm not sure if I'll see any hands up, so if you have questions, keep your hands up and I'll try to get to you when I can. The first slides are just basically why are these systems going wireless? Why are we doing these kind of things? Again, you can read as well as I do, but primarily it's what Nicholas Negroponte from MIT called the wireless switch. The things that were wired are going wireless. The wireless things are going wired. But as the wired turns into wireless, the same data that is moving over wired networks is now starting to go over wireless networks, and there are different issues that need to be dealt with. The main thing for commercial systems, and believe it or not, even some of the military systems, are driven by market requirements. The customers ask for particular things and make their requirements known. You'll see secure on that list. It hasn't been that clear up to this point from the marketplace that people are really willing to pay for that security. It seems most of the customers kind of expect it to be there and are surprised when it's not. So that should be familiar with anyone who deals with computer software. From the wireless point of view, the trust model that's put together has four separate segments. There's an access control that should look familiar. You attempt to authenticate a user to allow them to reach certain resources in the network. The link privacy is typically protected by encryption. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's not so good. A lot of times there are ways to negate the fact that it's encrypted. The link integrity goes to the authentication, spoofing, anti-replay kinds of things that are easier done on wireless networks than they are on wired. One of the big issues that are facing a lot of service providers is how much capacity do they have? How many customers can they serve, and what kind of data can they move through these networks? So one of the requirements, partially from a security perspective, is how do you keep track of those people and keep them happy and yet prevent them from taking over the network. In the United States, a government agency called the Federal Communications Commission is the authority on non-governmental frequency usage. They put out what are called RNOs, or report and orders, after typically a long series of fact-finding and industry questionnaire-type efforts. They come up with rules that specify a whole bunch of things. In this particular slide, the main issue is what frequencies out of the electromagnetic spectrum are a particular licensee going to be allowed to use. And what the FCC has done for many years is to separate them by use. So one of the most common would be the frequency allocation for FM radio. The numbers that you see correspond to what's on the dial. cellular telephones that are running around the United States work at, in the 800 megahertz band, and the PCS allocation that you see the chart for is up at 1900 megahertz, or 1.9 gigahertz. The two-way pagers that I walk around with, other people walk around with, operate down at 900 megahertz, and all the wireless cards that people are walking around with operate in what's called the ISM band. It's also been called the kitchen sink band because basically you can do whatever you want in that band. As it turns out, you can do whatever you want as long as you're not a communications provider. If you are a sawmill, for instance, you can use microwave dryers to dry plywood up in the 2 gigahertz range, and that's, you can basically use as much power as you want. FCC doesn't care. If you want to use that same band to send data, you have to follow some rules. So there's the FCC at work. The fundamental characteristics of a radio wave, there are really three of them, and two of them are related. The frequency is the inverse of the wavelength. So as you get higher in frequency, the wavelength gets shorter. Where this gets practical is it's a good determiner of how big of an antenna you need. AM antennas, you know, for old AM radio tend to be very large. FM radios, because they work at a much higher frequency, have shorter antennas. And the wireless cards at 2.4 gigahertz, the antennas can be very small. So if you've got a radio wave, there are basically three things you can do to it to impart information from a transmitter to receiver. You can vary the amplitude, which is what the A and AM modulation is. You can vary the frequency, which is what the F in FM is. Or you can change the phase. And again, I don't want to dig too far into this, but basically you can adjust the way the sine wave is delivered. You can change the phase and have the receiver detect those changes in phase. So you've got two common modulation schemes. One is FSK, or frequency key shifting, and the other is PS key, or phase shift keying. Those will come up again and again in different commercial applications. This is a chart just to give you an idea of the electromagnetic spectrum. The frequencies at the bottom are primarily military related, but you can see at the top how the bands are organized and where those initials UHF and VHF come from. What I've tried to do in this slide is to give you a generic architecture. You'll see this architecture or something very similar in almost every wireless network that we're going to look at. There's a mobile terminal that runs around inside the coverage area. It receives and transmits to a base station or a cell site or some fixed location that's got a receiver and a transmitter. That link has two parts to it. There's something called a forward link, which goes from the base to the mobile, and a reverse link that goes from the mobile back to the base station. The base station, and there's typically more than one of them, are connected to some kind of network control center or switching center, some intelligence that will be able to route the data correctly. And there's connections to the internet, to the telephone network, and to other private networks. So keep this in mind as we go through. Now the AirLink isn't perfect. When you're dealing with wired cable, you don't tend to have all these kinds of problems, especially with the kinds of mobile devices that are running around. The biggest challenge in designing these networks is how to adapt to a link quality that can go from very good to very bad very quickly. The biggest problem that's been seen in most of the networks is something called multipath, where the signal from the sender takes more than one path and gets to the receiver, and you'll see this in a slide in a minute. There's the obvious shadowing problems. Interference is a continuing problem, and we'll see some ways that designers have tried to get around that. And then attenuation is another physical phenomenon that you have to deal with. again, for multipath, there are multiple paths, and the biggest problem with this is that the timing gets skewed. So as the receiver's trying to figure out what the transmitter's saying, the timing's off, it gets multiple copies of it, and the receiver has to work very hard to either combine them or ignore the ones that are not as important. Interference, just a display of constructive and destructive, just to note that in almost all cases it's some form of destructive. It's very rare that it's actually constructive. If you've ever been driving, waiting at a stoplight, listening to an FM station, you may have heard this, that if you're sitting in one place, you can hear it fine. If you pull up 3 feet, you lose the station. What you're hearing is multipath, and the result of that is destructive interference. One of the biggest tools in the wireless designer's arsenal is the ability to error correct the data after it's been processed by the receiver. And from top to bottom, it's simplest through most complex. Parity codes, I'm guessing most people are familiar with here. CRCs, probably the same. Block codes, there are a variety of block codes that have been designed for the past 40 years or so. Some are better than others. Some are designed to work better on short blocks. Some are better on long blocks. The most common set of codes, I have to be careful, but they're... It's very common to find convolutional codes, which is it's basically you treat the stream of data through a shift register, and you put X number of bits in and you get Y bits out, where Y is bigger than X. So the shift register is adding redundancy to that message. The convolutional codes are characterized by something called a code rate, which is the ratio of the number of bits that go in versus the number of bits that go out, and what's called a constraint length, which is the number of bits that it's looking at a particular time to generate a new bit. Again, I don't want to dig too far into this, but I wanted to at least get you a feel for it. Now, concatenated codes are basically pick two or more of the above list. You can combine block codes with convolutional codes and get better performance depending on what your environment is. Before I go into this, are there any questions on any of that? Okay. I'll jump right in then. This describes the four different cellular systems that are active right now in the United States. The first one to come along was the analog or AMPS, which we'll look at in a minute. And then three different flavors of digital service, which again we'll go into. The network diagram looks very much the same as the other ones, and it provides the basic service that we've talked about. Again, a quick chart just to show you the differences, different channel sizes, and the biggest one from a commercial provider point of view is that bottom line that talks about capacity. And that's been the big driver to move from first to second generation. The main idea with cellular frequency reuse is that you're only getting a certain number of frequencies from the FCC, and it's very hard to get more. So the question was, how do we best make use of those frequencies? And the cellular idea is that instead of using that one frequency, let's say across a whole city, we use much lower powered transmitters and we reuse that frequency. And so if you have frequency A, you can reuse it several times within a city where you're licensed, and be able to, in this case, use it many times over. For all of the cellular-based systems, all of the base stations are connected to this MTSO. It's also sometimes called a mobile switching center. And it is the interface between all of these base stations and the PSTN. As the mobile moves through the coverage area, there's a procedure called a handoff that transfers the call from one base station to another. The first, it's not really the first system. There were mobile systems before this, but the first cellular system is called AMPS. It's what everybody calls 1G, the first generation now. The voice is delivered over the traffic channels in analog. The FCC has allocated 50 megahertz of it, and it's broken up into the channels, as you can see. It was designed primarily out of the Bell system in the 1970s, so there are some security issues that will become clear. This gives you a brief show of the protocol that goes on when a cellular telephone is first powered up, is what happens. The phone is pre-programmed to know what the control channels are. It knows the frequencies. So when it first powers up, it scans through those and tries to find the strongest one. If it doesn't find any, you get the light that lights up that says no service. If it does find one, it'll camp on it and begin listening to what are called overhead messages. The base station continuously transmits these overhead messages that describe what the system is, what's available, and what you have to do to get access to it. So after the mobile figures out whether this is the right one or not, it will send in a registration message, and that registration message will identify it to the system and let the system know where the mobile is, so that if anybody wants to get a hold of the mobile, the system will be able to find it quickly. So later, when a call does come in, the mobile is still camped on the control channel, and the base station sends a paging message out that says, I've got a call for this number. Whoever you are, tune to this voice channel and pick up the call. So at that point, the mobile will acknowledge, it'll retune to the voice channel and begin the conversation. Now, AMPS has a number of weaknesses, many of which have been well detailed. Because the voice is in analog, it's easy to listen to with any receiver that basically was built before 1994. At that point, a law went into place that prohibited in the United States the sale of those receivers. The Electronic Communications Privacy Act before that was modified to again make listening to the cellular frequencies illegal. Despite all that, there were clone phones running around that caused the industry quite a bit of heartburn. And there are some other issues that came up not quite so commonly. One was the ability to hijack calls. And the other was a tracking issue that we'll also talk about in a little bit. The tracking is an issue of how do you find the mobile. So one of the requirements that the FCC is dealing with now is what's called E911. One of the problems with the cell phones right now is when you call 911, most of the dispatchers don't know where you are, which is very different from a wired phone. So one of the requirements the FCC is trying to get all the carriers to agree to is that when a call is placed to 911, the wireless system, the cellular network, will deliver your location, something like less than 200 meters. So based on that, the question to the carriers is, okay, how do we do this? How can we actually provide that kind of information? The first is global positioning system, which I'm sure almost everybody is familiar with. There's an issue of cost there because each mobile now has to have a GPS receiver. The promise of $5 receivers hasn't quite come true yet, so that's an expense that the carriers don't want to go to, but it probably at this point is the most accurate. There are two other techniques that I'll talk about in a minute. The last one is called multipath fingerprinting. We talked about multipath initially about the different paths that a signal can take. The idea behind fingerprinting is that you can look at that from the mobile point of view, and when a mobile transmits to the base will see a certain pattern of arrivals of their message. Depending on where you are, that pattern is going to be unique. So so the idea is you drive around your system if you're the provider. You transmit from the major locations, from intersections, and at the system you take a picture of what the multipath looks like at the base station. Then later, when another mobile shows that same fingerprint, you know where he is. That's computationally intensive. It takes a lot of updating because as the environment changes, if buildings change, trees get leaves on them, a lot of things can change to screw up fingerprinting. The other two are cheaper, and I'll talk about those. Time difference of arrival, this is actually how GPS works, but the idea is that you've got the same signal that's arriving at different places at different times, and you correlate those times. The accuracy depends, again, on a lot of things. But the networks, the service providers like this because they only need equipment at the base stations. They don't need it in every mobile. And in fact, they can do this kind of thing right now. It's just an issue of do they provide it to the 911 answering centers or not. The other is angle of arrival. You know, the British were doing this in World War II to find U-boats. Same basic idea. Any questions on any of that? All right, we'll dive right into CDPD. Initially, when AMPS was first put online, the cellular carriers wanted to be able to provide data, and they didn't have quite as many customers as they do now. So they looked at their system and said, we've got idle channels. Can we move data over those idle channels? So what they did was put together this specification for CDPD that's an overlay on AMPS and uses the idle capacity in the network. The initial specifications were set up such that the carriers, since they were making more money from voice, they wanted voice to take priority. So if there's a voice call that has to go, the CDPD, which is packet-based, can wait. The two biggest providers in the country right now are AT&T and Verizon. The OmniSky service that you can get with this Minstrel modem, the add-on, that would be a CDPD service. CDPD is attractive for the data services because it's IP-based, at least at the interfaces. AT&T claims 150,000 customers, and as it turns out, a lot of those are police cars that are looking for a cheap way to get NCIC data, fingerprints, traffic checks, all that data moved out to the police car. The coverage is obviously focused on metropolitan areas and not even all of them. So if this is something that you're considering, you need to be careful about where you actually want to operate. CDPD, like most protocols, decided that it needed a new lexicon for things that were already familiar to people. So the mobile became a mobile end system, the base stations became a mobile database system or station, and so on. The CDPD modems are allowed to roam. You can be based in Chicago and go to San Francisco and still operate. The way it works is you are homed. Your home system would be in Chicago. The serving system would be in San Francisco, and you could still communicate. And we'll see an example of how that works. So when you roam, the packets that you're originating first go to the serving station. In this case, it'd be San Francisco. They would then traverse a CDPD backbone to get to your home system, to get back to Chicago, at which point it would authenticate you, it would serve your data, would give you the things you're waiting for, and return the data. The access to the internet or the fixed end system don't necessarily have to go through Chicago. They can actually go through San Francisco. The Airlink Gaussian minimum shift keying is just a way of being efficient in the 30 kilohertz channel that you've got. They can move 19.2 kilobits raw, but there's a lot of overhead. There's a lot of stuff that's carried along in there. The forward error correction is a block code and performs fairly well. The base station transmits a continuous forward link for the CDPD units when it's operating. The mobiles listen to that to determine whether the reverse link, which is shared, but they can't listen to, they use that to determine whether they can transmit. So the CDPD modem is listening to the forward link, it's waiting for the idle bit to become true. When it goes idle, the mobile then transmits. Now, it's possible that there's more than one mobile who transmit at the same time. That's a collision as far as the base station is concerned. So what the mobiles do is they transmit and then they listen to the forward link again to find out if their message actually got through. The packets that they send have a header, the data, and a frame check to be sure that it hasn't been damaged. Selective ARQ means that if a frame is damaged, the sender can resend it if it doesn't get an acknowledgement. When a unit comes up, when a CDPD modem is powered on and can actually find a unit that's working, it will send in a request to get an assignment. That TEI is the way that a CDPD network identifies the modem. In order for the unit to actually register itself with the home system and get data moving back and forth, the unit sends basically a hello message. And again, you can see the details here. The key point here is that message contains what CDPD calls credentials. And there are two parts to that. There's a random number and a sequence number. We'll see what happens with the random number. The idea behind the sequence number is implemented in other systems as well. The idea is that it's a different kind of shared secret. Every time the modem makes access to the network, that sequence number is incremented. So if someone tries to use old credentials or fake the credentials, the hope is that number will be wrong and the authentication would fail. So the hello message is sent from the mobile to the base. There's some interesting initial configuration characteristics. So it's known when a new modem comes up. Another interesting part is that the network keeps two credentials. There's the old one and the new one. There's an update procedure. It's possible that the update is completed by the network but not delivered to the end station. So the network maintains one new one and one old one. Again, this is more of a graphic description of how the procedure runs. Again, the even if you're in a foreign city, what's considered foreign, you can still be authenticated through your home system. All right, CDPD does have a number of problems. The first is a problem that a lot of networks have, which is the back end stuff, not the airlink itself, but the base stations, the network control, the databases that run the system can be accessible from the outside, and so they are vulnerable in the same way that other IP-based equipment is. There is in what we just saw, the protocol defines a redirect message so that if you are roaming in San Francisco, your home system in Chicago received a redirect that said all the traffic that's bound for this device redirected to San Francisco. Well, it may be possible to send in your own redirects to deliver traffic to a location that you designate rather than the serving. The same way that when you perform a redirect, what you get is an answer back from the home system that gives you a set of credentials. It tells you whether what you gave to it is correct or not. And so there's a possibility of submitting a whole stream of redirects and hoping that you'll hit one that's correct. Now, for denial of service, the link from the mobile to the base is just as weak for data as it is when you're talking on a cell phone. So you can do the same kinds of things to the data that you would to a cell phone. you can take advantage also of the business, which is the cellular provider wants a voice call. So if you want to block CDPD out of a cell site, all you need to do is place a sufficient number of analog calls, and there will be no CDP service there. The CDPD specification also talks about a command called ZAP. The idea is that they were afraid that there would be a modem that if it failed in a transmit mode, it would jam the reverse link. It would continuously transmit. So there is a forward link command that will silence a particular modem. Are there any questions on any of this? All right. With the analog system still running, as it turns out, the control channels aren't always terribly busy. And so there was an effort, and there are some products that make use of the spare time on a control channel. Basically, they take the messages that exist in the protocol, but they use them for their own purposes. So Celemetry is one of those services. Not that anybody here would do that, but if you were monitoring the links between mobiles and bases, you may see what look like registration messages that don't make any sense. And those may very well be from these kinds of telemetry units. All right, as cellular grew up, more and more people bought phones, and the service providers found out that they had more people wanting to make calls than they had capacity for. So they came up with IS-136, digital amps, and its primary difference is that the voice channels are now split up into time slots. Because of the current state of voice codecs, each call gets two time slots. So if you're a provider and you implement digital amps, you can now handle three times as many calls out of your particular license from the FCC than you could before. So again, the forward link, what in this picture is called outbound, is continuous. It's just time slot after time slot. On the inbound, the mobiles don't transmit all the time the way they do in amps. They only transmit on their assigned time. As digital amps was coming out, a company in San Diego called Qualcomm had an alternative that they wanted to use, which they called CDMA. It turns out it became a competitor. Sprint, PCS, and Verizon chose CDMA. It's a far more complicated method. It uses direct sequence spread spectrum in both directions. There is basically, out of any particular cell site, there's a pilot, you can call it a channel. There's a pilot channel that all the mobiles connect to and synchronize with. And there are 63 other channels. Almost all of them are voice. There are some paging channels. The implementation of CDMA took a while. It's a complicated system. It took a while to get things working. And there are still some issues with it, including something called power control, which we'll see here in a minute. Another spread spectrum technique that most people are actually using right now with 802.11 is called frequency hopping. Out of all the possible frequencies you can use, instead of just using one and staying on it the whole time, you hop from one to another. It requires that the receiver and the transmitter be synchronized, so they're both hopping at the same time, at the same rate, to the same place. And for the 2.4 gigahertz that people are using, the FCC requires that you hop among at least 75 frequencies, and you transmit on any one frequency for no longer than 400 milliseconds. All right, direct sequence. There actually is a specification for 802.11 for direct sequence. This, again, is more complicated than some of the other ones. The idea is that you've got a certain amount of bandwidth that you can use. And so the question becomes, how do you fit as many people as possible in there? For direct sequence, if you take your data and you spread it out, what they call spreading, you convert that data in each data bit into a series of what direct sequence calls chips. The effect of doing that is to flatten what they call the power density. and spread it out. And if you spread enough, and if you do it well enough, the signal, instead of appearing as a spike like the narrowband, it flattens out and begins to look like normal background noise. What you would hear is if you tune the receiver to a frequency that doesn't have anything on it. What that gives you is a lot of benefits. For the military, they use it quite a bit. And the LPI LPD is low probability of intercept, low probability of detection, which is obviously something they want. It also gives you very good anti-jam protection, because any particular narrowband jammer will be the effects of that will be lost when you do what's called despreading. The pattern of those chips comes from what they call a PN code. There are certain sets of PN codes that you want to use. And again, just like in frequency hopping, you need to synchronize the receiver and the transmitter. That synchronization in the receiver is called correlation. And so here's an example of how that would work. In the top lines, what we're doing is taking our data bits and using what they call a spread ratio of 4:1. We begin our PN, and we simply convert the ones and zeros into either the PN or the inverse of the PN, depending on which bit it is. Again, you can read through the example here. That what gets sent then is the line called spread. So at the receiver is listening to this wideband signal, and it's got the same copy of the PN. And so during correlation, what you do is you slide the PN code back and forth until what you get out is basically a spike. You get the individual segments back that you can identify as bits. If you're off, you can see the example at the bottom that what you get back is not right. The direct sequence is that the data bits are converted directly into a sequence, into the PN sequence. All right, with IS-95 or really any terrestrial-based CDMA, there's some issues. One of the first things that people found out was that cell sites do something that they call breathing in the industry. CDMA systems are limited by noise, since each signal that's coming into it from all these units looks like noise. There's a maximum number of units that can actually transmit, and that number depends on a lot of things, and one of those is the amount of power that they use to transmit. The more power that's used, the fewer users you can get. What the system does is that pilot channel that we talked about will vary its power output depending on how heavily loaded it is. So if it's lightly loaded, the power on the pilot will be high, trying to cover as much geographic area as possible. As the load increases, as more mobiles are transmitting, as the base station's receiving more signals, the pilot will reduce its power so that it won't be accepting additional units, and the effective coverage area will shrink, and that's called breathing. And so a lot of the initial CDMA installations, they ran into this problem. They would have great coverage at night, but during heavy times of the day, there would be these huge coverage gaps. CDMA is different in the AirLink, but it's got the same kind of back-end processing, same kind of switch issues, same kind of security and accessibility issues. The other issue that isn't so big anymore, but initially was bad, was that there was only one place to go to get IS-95, and that's Qualcomm. All right, the third system that's much more popular in other parts of the world than here is GSM. It was a design from the 80s that the Europeans tried to get all their different countries and different systems to come under one banner so that you could, in theory, roam from Norway down to Italy. technically you can. As it turns out, in reality, what you need is what are called roaming agreements with the different providers, and that's lacking between a lot of these countries. But in any case, there are companies here in the United States that are using GSM. VoiceStream and Singular are the biggest. AT&T is transitioning from their TDMA system to GSM. GSM natively provides short message service, which we'll talk about in a little bit. The frequency layout is a little different. The interesting thing about GSM was that they tried to separate, for authentication purposes, they tried to separate equipment identities from user identities. And the way that they did that was through a subscriber information module, or a SIM. So there's really two numbers associated with a GSM call, if you will. There's an identity that's assigned to the hardware that is supposed to be unchangeable. And it's got the pieces, as you see here. The other piece of information is a subscriber identity. And that subscriber identity goes in the SIM, goes in the smart card that plugs into the phone. Now, GSM uses digital speech. This is just a diagram of some of the complexities that go into getting the speech from the microphone out to the AirLink. There's a fair amount of work there. Fortunately, all of this is now handled in VLSI chips, so you can buy semiconductors that'll do this work for you. I'll go into more detail in the second talk about this, but essentially the cryptography that's used in GSM has a lot of problems. You can read here why. The biggest problem is they didn't release the algorithms to anybody. You had to be part of the GSM MOU, the Memorandum of Understanding. You had to sign promises that you won't tell anybody about it, and so on and so on. As it turns out, the authentication algorithms have problems. The privacy algorithms are now, the ones that are used in the U.S., you can crack in real time. And so it's not all it's cracked up to be. The short message service is the data service of GSM. It kind of started out through GSM as something that they said, well, we've got the path there, let's add it in. They didn't really expect too many people to use it. As it turns out, people are using that quite a bit. The success of that in GSM led the TDMA and the CDMA people to say, well, we want that too, and so they ended up with add-ons that are more or less similar. SMS isn't perfect. The early prepay phones had an interesting feature that since they didn't really expect anybody to use it, they didn't bother to collect time for it. And so you could, if you had one of these prepaid phones early on, you could send and receive as many SMS messages as you want. You'd never get a bill for it. SMS data here is delivered over the telephone signaling network, and there are ways of changing the identification data that's on that network so you can send messages to somebody and pretend to be somebody else. There are talk about SMS viruses that you need a particular phone to do that, and you need a phone that will automatically process an SMS message. And then there was a spate for a while of particular binary messages that would crash certain types of phones. IDEN is, most people know it as Nextel. But IDEN is the technology name that Motorola gave their particular dispatch service. Started out as, if you owned a fleet of trucks and you had repair people floating around, you would use Nextel to be able to dispatch them. As they continued to field that, customers asked, well, can I make phone calls on it? So they connected the network to the phone system, and now you've got a cell phone. The biggest advantage that the Nextel people say they've got is the one push to talk. So you can talk on your unit and everybody in your group can hear it, no matter where they are. It's got yet another AirLink setup. It's also TDMA, but the format's different. The way they slice it up is different. They use a digital voice algorithm called VSELP, which is a Motorola proprietary. But again, you can monitor this if you have the right test equipment. All right, now we're getting into some of the private data networks that exist. There's a service called Mobitex that is it's somewhere between CDPD and a two-way pager. The idea is that you can send and receive short messages, you can maybe get through to databases, but you wouldn't want to move large amounts of data on it. Here in the U.S., Singular offers the service. It was originally designed by Ericsson in Europe, and they claim 750,000 customers. It is the other service you can get for your Palm. If you sign up for palm.net, what you'll get is a Mobitex modem. Coverage, again, is they claim it's a little better than CDPD, but depending on where you are, it may or may not work for you. The same kind of generic network setup, it looks pretty similar to most of the others that we've seen. The mobiles can transmit up to 2 watts. Mobitex is not nearly as private as Singular might tell you. The specification for the system has been available through licensees, and people have gotten it. Many years ago, there was source code that came out on one of the Usenets, came out anonymously, that had a proof of concept code that if you had a receiver or a scanner that would cover 800 megahertz and you had a PC, you could make a little interface board and you could monitor the Mobitex in your area. It would have the same kind of weaknesses that any other IP-connected system would have, and so you'd be able to get in and fiddle around with their exchanges using IP. Artis is a service that's roughly comparable to Mobitex. It was originally designed by Motorola for IBM. The company used to be called Motion, is now called Mobile Satellite Ventures, that provides a service. They claim they're very busy. They don't have as many stations, but their stations are more powerful. And again, you can get to them through IP. The network itself looks similar to most other people's networks. As usual, they have different names for all the familiar things. The AirLink, there's two different ones. The first one was a 4800 baud link. The newest one is 19.2, so if you're in the right area, you can get about twice as much as what you'd get with Mobitex. Different message sizes, and they also have forward error correction. Artis uses a couple of different protocols to get data in and out of their system. The message generator is a particularly interesting one because in some places you can just submit basically whatever information you want into these fields. And from the receiver, from the mobile point of view, all this data is spoofed without too much trouble. The modem itself, in order to make it easy to use, they set it up to use AT commands. They changed the meaning of some of the registers, there's a quote there from their developer's manual that kind of talks about the level of sophistication that they use to deal with different messages. Also within that developer's document, they have recommendations for security. One of the first things was suggesting that, well, maybe you want to use your own end-to-end encryption. So I think even they recognize that they may not be as good as they hoped. As it turns out, you cannot encrypt everything. You can only encrypt the payload. You have to keep certain things in the clear. and they recommend that the device basically be reachable and controllable remotely. All right, there's another private network that maybe some of you have heard of called Ricochet. Basically, if you were in the coverage area, you'd go out and look at the light poles, and there'd be a little shoebox-sized thing hanging upside down with a little whip antenna on it. Those are the Ricochet modems. They use what they call a mesh topology to get from your modem across these light poles to a wireless access point. The modems themselves operate frequency hopping in the unlicensed area of 900 megahertz. The pole tops talk to each other both through licensed and unlicensed frequencies. The network itself, again, is familiar with most of the ones that we've seen already, with the exception that pole top radios can talk to each other. So the message that you originated at your modem may hop through several pole top radios before it actually gets to a wired location. Now, Ricochet was originally put out by a company called Metricom. Metricom had the commercial Ricochet, and they also did utility monitoring. As it says here, they went into bankruptcy. Aerie Networks came in and bought the remainder. They're claiming that they're going to field a second generation that'll be much faster. They're testing in Denver right now, and they're saying that it works very well. Any questions before I dive into paging? Okay, either this is really interesting or you're all asleep. Flex came out of Motorola. They primarily due to loading issues. The earlier protocols were full, and operators wanted the ability to move more data to more customers. So Flex uses, in its highest incarnation, it uses a four-level frequency shift keying. There are decoders for that, by the way. The Flex itself works on a series of cycles. The primary consideration here, besides capacity, is battery life. I've got a Reflex pager here. It's got a single AA battery in it, and the service providers want that thing to last as long as possible. So the idea is that the pager will go to sleep for as long as possible, and we'll see that here in a minute. So Flex started out as the one way that you have a pager, but all you can do is receive pages. The cap codes are the identities that are associated with each message, and there are two kinds. Motorola has also made available, but I don't think too many people used it, something they called the Flex Suite, which is a developer's suite that you can use to put together Flex applications. Turns out that the killer application is just email. So after Flex, they came out with something called Reflex, which is now the two-way paging. Because of an FCC frequency allocation, there could be now, and are, nationwide mobile paging providers that are using Reflex. And they use the frequencies here that are assigned. The idea now is that instead of just a receiver, your pager's got a tiny little transmitter in it, and it will talk back to a paging tower, either with canned messages or with the response that you type in yourself. And again, the network to do that looks like most others. Inbound messaging, again, the inbound channel is shared by all of the pagers, but the pagers can't hear that channel, so they don't know if anybody's on it. The way that Reflex dealt with this problem, they have what's basically an assignment channel that's Aloha, like Ethernet, where the mobile will send a request, and what will come back is an assignment that says, okay, this assignment, this time slot now, it will be yours. You can go ahead and send your data on this. And all the other pagers presumably agree not to transmit during your time slot. The forward link from the base, again, this is where we get into sleep. The reason the battery can last for weeks and weeks is that most of the time the pager is asleep. it wakes up just before the beginning of a particular cycle. And so depending on the network provider, you can deliver, if you time your messages right, you will send them only when the pager is awake, and all the other time it'll be asleep.
Mm-hmm.
Many, the signals will originate from a network center. Many of them will go out over satellite to remote towers. There are a few that are wired links, but yeah, I think more than 80% of them are satellite based. All right, Bluetooth. It's difficult to know where to begin with Bluetooth. If anybody's ever tried to go through the specifications, they're just awful. They're at 1.1, they're working on 1.2, but they're thick going. The idea behind Bluetooth initially was to get rid of cables so that you wouldn't have to connect a cable from your laptop to your cell phone, to your PDA and all that. As they continued to develop the specification, more and more people came up with more and more things they wanted to do. So all of this got dumped into the specification. But the original idea was that Bluetooth is going to be a short-range personal area network, that these devices would ad hoc form up into piconets and they'd all be able to trade data with each other. The AirLink is, again, frequency hop. It hops quite a bit faster than 802.11. That doesn't always help. There's some interesting interrelationships and jamming between 802.11 and Bluetooth. But regardless, you can have 8 units in this PicoNet. The master, which doesn't mean anything other than it's the one that sets up the hop sequence, controls the timing of the what it calls slaves. It uses Gaussian minimum shift keying, uses phase shift keying, binary, so there are only 2 shifts. It uses forward error correction. They claim that it'll run very fast, and there are 79 hop frequencies in the United States that it'll run through. Now each unit maintains its own clock running at this 3.2 kilohertz rate. Divide that by 2 and you've got your hop rate. Bluetooth devices, again, now we're back to power issues. Bluetooth uses, they can be in 4 different modes. The master and the ones that are talking will be active. Sniff is part of determining what else might be out there, if anybody out there is interesting to talk to and might have a service. You can wake up and sniff for what's out there, and if not, go back to sleep. Hold is basically look once and go back to sleep. And park is wake up only occasionally, stay synchronized, but don't do anything else. There's 3 sections to the protocol stack. The primary one that we'll be looking at here is the transport group, which is on the bottom. Transport group encompasses all these pieces. Basically, it takes all of the issues with the radio and all of the processing, all the protocol issues, and provides a clean interface to the middleware group. As we get into the authentication steps, these are some of the different pieces that you'll see as we go through. The issue in the specification, it's not clear why they chose what they chose. The device address happens to be like the IEEE Ethernet MAC assignments, but the other stuff, there didn't seem to be a lot of rationale for it. Bluetooth security, you can have none, a little bit, or just a little bit more than that. And again, the distinction is whether you establish a channel and then try to be secure, or whether you try to be secure before you make a deal with somebody else. And again, if you're the owner of a device, you can call it trusted or untrusted with other devices, and you can specify different levels of who you want to be able to talk to these devices. Each Bluetooth unit has a unit key. It's typically generated when the device is first used and is from then on used no matter what. There is a procedure to get a new one, but it's not typically used. So if you've got two Bluetooth devices that want to talk to each other, the way it reads is you've got two parties. You've got a verifier and you've got a claimant. The verifier makes up a random number and sends it to the other guy and then computes an initial key using that information and a PIN. The PIN can be like an ATM PIN for devices that can't accept input. You can have a fixed PIN that will never change. Again, not great. So you've got this initial key, and now you want to authenticate to a device. You generate the random number, you send it to the other device. The device sends back its address, that 48-bit address. And then you run an algorithm that's based on SAFER, and you get two values out. You get a signed response, and you get a cipher offset, which you'll see how those are used in a minute. The slave device, the second device, sends its signed response back to A, and you could do it vice versa, so they could authenticate each other. So once you're authenticated, now you've got to agree on a link key, and there are two different kinds of link keys. If you've only got a single unit that will be able to derive a key, or you just want to use it that way, you can just use the unit key from one device. Again, this spells out how to generate that. Their highly secure method is you can use both unit keys. So now that you've got a link key, now you actually have to generate an encryption key that you're going to use for the data itself. And there's yet a third function to generate that. And the offset can either be what you generated in your authentication step with the other side, or if you're a master that's going to broadcast to several devices, you can just use your own address and concatenate it with itself. So then you actually do the encryption. You just exclusive OR it through this function called E0. The clocks, again, have to be synchronized. The clock's a 28-bit value. That at link establishment, the slave has its own clock, but it'll have an offset so that the master clock and the slave clock will be identical and in step. All right, given all that, there are some issues, obviously. The first one is not even related to the crypto, but because of the permanent address, you can track these devices. So if somebody's walking around with their Bluetooth unit, you can follow where they've been. The authentication is true with a lot of systems that the user isn't the one being authenticated, it's just the device. So if anybody's got it, they can be authenticated. The data that's flowing back and forth until you've got an encryption key, those keys are in the clear, so you can sniff those. The long-term link keys are also a problem, because if you're part of a PicoNet, you can kind of follow along with everybody, generate a link key, and later come back and spoof as a different device. Okay, I'm seeing 0 minutes here, so I'm almost done. The third generation is what the wireless telephony is supposed to go to. There's a European-based 3GPP that has tried to learn from the lessons of the past. They're going to do open crypto. They're going to show you what the algorithms are. They're looking for feedback. And they're going to have all these add-ons onto GSM. They're going to have faster data. They're going to have multimedia data where you can move audio and video. And again, just trying to tack on to GSM all of these other added features. So that was the overview. Hopefully I at least said something that would be of interest to people here. Since we're out of time, I'll be happy to take your questions one-on-one if you want to come up and talk. Otherwise, thank you very much for your polite attention.